Have you ever watched an apocalyptic sci-fi movie and wondered, could any of this really happen? I'm Carrie Bechet, and on Hypothetical, we explore what-if questions two ways, through speculative science fiction and through insight from the world's most brilliant scientists. And spoiler alert, your favorite sci-fi movies aren't nearly as far-fetched as you may think. Time travel with me into our possible futures on Hypothetical. New episodes every Tuesday, available on all podcast apps. That's Hypothetical, Hyperthetical.
Welcome to Frepow. We're your hosts, Odd and Rags.
This week, we get the honor of talking to Ebony. She is a Black bi woman who's also a nurse, and we talk to her about her experiences just throughout her life. We hope you guys really enjoyed this episode. Ebony is such a delight and has a lot of really interesting stories, and most of all, a lot of compassion for fellow humans.
Okay, so we're going to get started.
Okay.
Okay. And we always start with the easiest, slowest pitch. Tell us about yourself.
So my name is Ebony. I'm 40 years old. I've been married almost 20 years. And I have two children, one living, and my daughter's 16. I just graduated nursing school. And I'm getting ready to take the NCLEX the end of the month, and I work at a hospital.
That was pretty good intro.
That's really exciting. My one of my sisters just finished her nursing degree in last spring, and it was like a wild ride. Like, I had no idea.
I have a newfound respect for nurses. At first, I used to be like, you're just the nurse, you're not the doctor. But now, having gone through this entire process, doesn't even compare. I have such a respect.
No, nurses know what's up. My mom was a nurse practitioner. She was like, knew the most out of anybody.
I would rather have a nurse practitioner than a doctor any day.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And my sister is actually in pediatrics, and so I get the cutest stories.
Yeah, I actually have dreams of being in the NICU. That's where my heart is, because that's where my children were. Mm-hmm. My son passed in the NICU, and my daughter was in the NICU for a month. So I was constantly in the NICU. They actually knew me by name.
That's very interesting, because I hadn't thought about that. But my sister, who's a nurse, she was in NICU. She was born 6 weeks early, I think. She, you know, tiny itty bitty thing. And that makes a lot of sense now, why she wants to do pediatrics.
Yeah. And I think for me, it's about being there for other people. Like, to experience loss and to experience the stress and trauma of having a NICU baby, you can't really understand it if you've never been through it. So that's the main reason why I wanted to be there.
That's great. And so do you have to pass this nursing test in order to get your license?
Yes.
It is my license. This nursing test that's haunting your life.
I mean, that sucks, because you've gone through all this schooling. You know, you would figure you... I mean, I understand why it's there, but it's like... You've done all the schooling and all the other stuff, and like, now you have to take this test to get the license. That's like...
And that's the thing. It's like, everything is riding on this.
I know how much you've been studying for this, and I know that nursing really does mean a lot to you. Now, you shared with me that you do maybe have some stories about being a nurse with some questionable patients. I mean, obviously, we don't want to divulge, we don't want to break HIPAA, but like,
these are
stories that are pertaining to something that I think is very important.
Of course. So, the first thing I'll say is that it's definitely interesting being in this, you know, position, dealing with the older population, particularly, and some younger population where they don't necessarily share your views. But you have to, and it's your duty to take care of them, regardless of how they treat you, what they say, what they do. And the most thing that the thing that happens often is you get mistaken. Now, I have been in nursing for a very long time. I've worked my way up. I started as a CNA, an HSA, an aide. I did everything except nursing. So I don't think that there's anything less of being an aide. But oftentimes when you go in and you are the nurse, you are presumed to be the aide. So people, when you answer like a call bell, you'll see a couple of us, I belong to a couple of groups, and they'll say, when you answer like a call bell or something, they'll be like, oh, can you get me something? Can you tell the nurse to come here? Well, I am the nurse. And oftentimes you'll get servitude requests that something someone else can do, which I don't have a problem doing anything I can do to help a patient. But that it does make you feel a kind of a way. Like some people don't necessarily respect or respond to you appropriately, regardless of if they know that you're the nurse or not. Actually, sometimes they do know and they still won't. You know, I also had one time I went down to the city with a friend, and this is me not even in the capacity of nursing, but as a friend. And I was wheeling my friend around. He was very sick and I was wheeling him in. And when I got in there, the nurse said to me, oh, are you his aide? And he got very upset and very offended because he was like my best friend. He since passed, but he said, no, she's my friend. She's a family friend. But initially, the first thing that has happened is people automatically assume that I'm an aide, which is kind of frustrating when you study and you work so hard. But, you know, it's what you got to deal with. I've also had patients say things that were interesting. When I worked in a nursing home, there were several patients who I don't think they did it intentionally per se, but they would drop the N-word like it was nothing to me. Like I'm like, so, you know, I got to change you. And they're like, yeah, you want to know something? I have N-word babies in my belly. And they would say just weird, crazy things about not necessarily, you know, committing violent acts against, you know, Black people, but they would just make interesting comments and they would have no problem flaring off the N-word. And you have to just understand that they're in a part of, it's like not quite a psychosis, but they're not, I don't think they truly realize what they're saying. Or maybe they just don't care. I don't know. But I try to give everybody the benefit of the doubt. So it does make your job difficult. I've also had patients say they don't want a Black nurse. They don't want a Black aide. And so then you're stuck where they don't want you in a kind of way.
Now, like, is there ever a time where you felt unsafe? So you actually said, I'm not going to take this patient? Like, is that an option?
That is definitely, if I felt unsafe, I certainly could.
Okay.
I mean, you could go to your charge nurse and surely they probably, I mean, it would all depend though, if the ratios are right and if they had somebody to, you know, so it would all depend, but more than likely, if you feel unsafe, then you can request a change of a person, you know, a patient.
Right. Man, that just has to like grate you down though over time, because I know you personally and I know how hard you've worked, you know, and I also know that you're just an amazing, sweet human being that cares so much. And then just to walk into these patients' rooms to basically just be invalidated, you know, that has to really just over time grate you down.
You would think, but and it does. It does. Sometimes it really does hurt. And it's frustrating. But it happens so much throughout my life outside of that, that it's kind of like, it's one of those things where you're just like, okay, I'm just going to discount everything you have to say off. I know you're ignorant. So just keep it moving because it's not worth it. Mm-hmm. So like, it's not worth it. And most times I can get over that. And if I can't, then I need to take a break. I need to go to the bathroom, get a cup of ice, and then, you know, come back. You know, we still have to remain professional, even if somebody's yelling in our face, you know, even if it's not race related, no matter what it is, we have to do our job. And my job is to make sure that you're safe, that you're healthy, and that you're getting better on your treatment plan.
You know, I'm just, as you're saying about how it's your job to make sure your patients are safe and it's your job to make sure that they stay healthy, I'm just kind of like drawing parallels to a different occupation where they are supposed to keep people safe and are supposed to protect people, but instead they do the exact opposite. And it's like, well, if you can do your job facing, you know, this racism and these words and these feelings, you know, maybe all day, every day, depending on, you know, the time and the week and the month, other people can do their jobs too. And, you know, also do them correctly without harming people. You know, I think we do owe a lot to nurses, and I think that we really should be looking to them on how to handle a lot of de-escalation and a lot of dangerous situations where they do have to keep people safe, though.
Absolutely. I agree with that 100%. And social workers, like, therapeutic communication is key with de-escalation. And the thing I believe the reason that we're having the situation that we're having is because they can. It's much easier and much faster to win a fight by punching somebody in the eye than it is to try to reason and talk with someone and de-escalate them and try to have therapeutic communication with someone, try to understand.
I think it's also like not getting at the root of the problem, because who is the root of the problem?
Right. Yeah. That I agree with that. And I think that because they can and they have systems in place that allow them to do that without penalty, then what's the point? Even if, you know, there have been, you know, some people who have been disciplined and moved to another departments and then they do it again. So if you don't have any penalty, then why would you not do something that's easy so you can just go home? Like, no biggie. And maybe you even feel, maybe you are an aggressive person. Maybe you're angry and maybe you want to take it out. And you know what? Just this one person talking to you any kind of way and you feel like you can do it. I don't know.
It's just making me think of the autistic man who was in South Florida, I think, a few years ago, who was confronted with the police in a very violent way. And his aide was with him. And the aide tried to de-escalate the situation. But obviously, the autistic man got very overwhelmed. And he is nonverbal mostly and was having a really hard time, like, trying to process, you know, what was going on, and then also like express himself. And the police like beat him very badly into submission, versus like this aide that was there was like trying to explain to them, like, you know, like, he's autistic. I have to just talk to him. Things will be fine. Like, he's not doing anything. And I mean, obviously this applies like across the board. It's like, you need de-escalation. You have to like care about someone and respect them as a human, you know, like start there and then like show compassion. And that has like been complete, like you said, like completely overwritten, because it's much easier to assert power and dominance and like stomp something out.
Exactly. I mean, I also recall, I believe, wasn't the aide shot? If it wasn't that one,
I think there was a different situation where
there was
a nonverbal autistic man plus an aide, but the aide was black, I believe, and the autistic man was a person of color.
He's Hispanic.
Yeah. And so the autistic man was sitting on the ground, I think, like playing with a truck or something like that. And the aide laid on the ground with his hands like against the ground or up in the air. I can't remember, but his hands were visible, saying like, please don't hurt him. Please don't hurt him. And then they shot the aide instead. But all of this is to say that like, there are de-escalation tactics that get taught to medical workers that work very well. And I mean, I used to volunteer in a hospital. And I remember having to, like, I used to do the transport. I used to transport all sorts of patients to their next destination, whether it was like radiology or whatever. And every now and then we did have a patient that was a little bit more violent. And, you know, I was a minor. So I had to walk with a couple of nurses who would help de-escalate and talk them down. You know, like there are options, you know, not everybody who's in the hospital is going to be passive.
No, people aren't happy. People are not typically happy when they're not feeling at their best.
Right.
And that's something you go in with the understanding that they're not happy. You try, and I try, you know, I am not a nurse yet. I'm still a pheb, but as a phlebotomist, that's what I do. I try my best to go in there. They already don't like when I come in because they know what's going to happen.
Because you're going to stick
and,
them.
Exactly. And I try to make them have the best day that I can make at that moment. That's it. And we know that. And unfortunately, I think there has been a environment and a culture in policing that in some ways they enjoy, but that is acceptable to be aggressive, to be violent towards people they don't like.
It's almost encouraged.
Yeah, that's the word I was looking for.
And I think it goes even like deeper than that. Like not even just people they don't like, but it's like the biases that they don't even know that they might hold. Like it's a subconscious thing. Things that they were just taught, like ideas that have been passed down when they're in training, or I've seen a lot of issues around respect. Like if they feel like you're disrespecting them, that is a huge issue. And it's like, again, it's like a power and control struggle constantly. And so if they feel like that power has been taken away from them, they use the tools that they've been given, but the tools that they've been given are like aggression.
And it's also, I also know from personal experience that it's not just that. I mean, if it was just, you know, violence against people of color, violence against Black women, violence against any citizen, then that's one thing. But there's actually a lot more to it. Like, I mean, the experiences, I don't know how many I shared with you, Chelsea, but, oh, I didn't know if we were using real names.
No, you're fine.
You're fine.
The experience, one of the first experience, and so I'm sorry, I just want to say that I know that sometimes they do know their biases and they intentionally do things to try to get a reaction in order to then inflict violence. So one of my earliest situations that I had with the police, first of all, I've never like had any, never even skipped school. I was like the nerd of all nerds.
I know, you seem like a very sweet baby angel. Like,
I mean, if you cross me, you're going to have a problem. But I mean, overall, I care about everybody. If you didn't have a friend, I would be your friend. That's just how I am. So I was taking my friends to, and it's interesting, he was my ex-boyfriend, but I was taking them to go see some girls. So there was three Black men in my car and myself. I'm 17, 18 years old, and I remember when I worked at Wawa, I used to know one cop, and he always told me, if you go into this town, just try to get through this town as quickly as possible, because they're going to be following you, and the chances are, if they find any reason, they'll stop you. I mean, it's a known thing in certain areas that this happens. So one day, like I said, I was taking my friends, knowing that. So I automatically set my speed right at speed, not even 5 miles over, right at speed limit. And I missed the turn. So I was coming down the street. I pulled into a driveway. I backed out like a K-turn and I crossed over a four-way stop and a police officer came. So I was so confused. I was like, I didn't run it. I stopped like a total stop. Like I followed all the rules. Like, why am I being pulled over? So as he's coming up to me to talk, in the back of my rear mirror, you could see that another cop was coming and he stopped on the other side perpendicular to our road because it's a four-way stop. And then another cop car came. There was four cop cars, and each of them were on different roads of the four-way section. I was so nervous. I forget what he asked me for, but I couldn't find it. So he made all of us get out. All of us put our hands on each car individually. There was, like I said, four guys. And he searched my car. Now, I did not know anything about, you know, what's legal, what's right, you know. And it, honestly, in that moment, as we've seen in the past, it doesn't matter. Whatever they tell you to do is what you need to do to be safe. So he searched my car. I was never given a ticket. He questioned each of the boys. And then at the end, I saw that it could, I was nervous, but I remembered that the cop who used to come into the store I worked in, and he loved me. He used to come in every day and call me Sunshine. Even if he didn't want coffee, he came in just to see me. So I said his name. I said, he's going to pick on me the next time he sees me because he told me, you know. And but because I said his name, the guy came over to me and he was like, hey, you know so-and-so? And I said, yes, I know him, you know, for a past year. And he's like, hold on. Meanwhile, we're all in pause on a different cop car spread out, just waiting. He calls the guy. And he makes him come to the scene. And it's at that moment that I was like, because he came right over. He was like, hey, what you doing? He's like, I told you, you know, not to speed or whatever it was. But he lightened the tension that was there. And just him being there, it was like, ah, all right, guys, go have a good time. Just don't speed. And I was just like, after all of this, but, you know, we got in our car, went our way, was a little shaken up, but we went on our way.
No, I'm really glad that you said that because I think in our area, it's like super common to see like in what you know is like a white suburb, more wealthy. I know that I've seen it several times that whenever there is, it makes me really like really upset like thinking about it. But I've seen so many like black teenagers being pulled over and there are like four, six cop cars and you're like, why? That's like all the cop cars of this town.
It almost just seems excessive though. Cause
no,
like,
it's absolutely.
It's more than excessive.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to say. Because for no traffic stop, do you really need to come out of your car with, you know, the bulletproof vest and the guns and the batons and all that stuff? And like, you can say whatever the hell you want about them being safe. But at the end of the day, most drivers, especially in New Jersey, are unarmed. Like, that's just the case of it. And like, if it's just going to be a routine traffic stop of somebody speeding or something so minor, you don't need to show up with that much force. But what your story is, it demonstrates how much more force they show up with versus like if I get pulled over, you know?
Yeah, and not even having any reason to really pull me over. Like, he couldn't give me a ticket. And I mean, as I recall my childhood, I know for a fact that there were certain places that your friends would tell you, listen, whatever you do, do not get pulled over. If you get pulled over in this town, on this road, you are going to get beat up. It's something that they whisper to you and you know, and nobody else knows because you don't see it. And this is before cell phones. And I'm not trying to date age myself, but I did tell it already. But this is before all of those things. So there was nothing. There was nothing. This is not really anything new. And that's the thing that hurts me. I'm very happy, to be honest, my response to everything that's going on now is because it's like someone saying that they're Superwoman and they believe they're Superwoman and you can't tell them they're not Superwoman. And they say everywhere they go, I'm Superwoman. And everybody just like, okay. And then one day you have to act in some way and people say, she's Superwoman. And like, I've been trying to tell you I was Superwoman this whole time. There's such a relief that comes when somebody can recognize something that has been denied for so long, has been explained away, has been denied, has been completely taken and turned and switched into something else. And that's why I'm so vocal now. I mean, it was pretty, I mean, I've gone through phases where it's like, do I really want to put this picture as my profile pic? Because there's been studies. Well, my name is Ebony, so therefore, oh my gosh. I mean, and these things are real, and people don't, either they don't know, they don't care, or they are doing it. So it's nice to see that people are seeing that some of this stuff is, it didn't go anywhere. You know, no more the feel good, oh, we get along, you know, you know, even Michael, as much as, you know, everybody wants to have their own thing, we are the world, blah, blah, blah. Even he said, you know, all I want to say is they don't really care about us. And it's not that I don't think people don't care. I think a lot of people don't know or didn't have it in an upfront to see it so blatantly as we've seen it. But it has been throughout my life, I have seen a lot of things, unfortunately, that were not positive.
Yeah. Well, I think the pandemic, good, bad, there is like one positive thing that has come out of it. If we were to glean one positive, it would be the fact that people are home and they're forced to pay attention because they don't have sports. They don't have things to distract them. They're kind of forced to pay a lot more attention now, which is why I think people are starting to tune in more and they're starting to come into this conversation more because where are you going? Everything's shut down. You know, you're kind of forced to sit in your discomfort of like, well, first of all, you're not social distancing and you're causing the second wave. But also, like, you are a part of what's happening, whether you know it or not. And we all have to take the step back to talk about this.
And examine ourselves. Because I find in speaking to a lot of people, some people who I know, who know me and love me, but some of the things that they say sometimes have you just, I think people don't realize that when you say or have a thought or a belief about something, that you can't discount it off and say, oh, well, you're different. You know, it really forced, I think, a lot of people to self-reflect and examine, is this really okay? Is it acceptable that I feel this way and why? And you're surely going to have people who say, oh, it's okay. And I'm going to defend it. I mean, it is very difficult for someone to tell you that you did something wrong and accept that, you know what? Maybe I did. No, I didn't. I mean, you have people who are going to be vehemently fighting against everything that you're saying. And I had that experience, Chelsea. You know, we went back and forth over ableism and you know, I had to take a step back. And that's why that gave me the strength to understand that some of these people are just fighting themselves. They just are fighting themselves. And like your initial reaction to something is not necessarily truly how you feel, but it's just your reaction. So I was like, what do you mean? That's not what I did. Then I had to take a step back and say, well, did I? And then I had to do research to understand, like back up and say, hey, well, what is this? So people have to ask themselves, did me saying, because I have black friends, does that make me racist? Like people had to really sit down and say, is what I'm doing a cause or the effect? And am I contributing or helping?
Right. And I think with that also, like you and I talked about it, and I think that's another part of it is that you and I, we talk very honestly and openly, and we always have. For the amount of time that we've known each other, we've always been very honest and open. So that means that like you didn't agree with the statement, and I just said, here's what I know. Here's what we can talk about, and if I don't know this, here are the articles. And if you have any questions, I will happily try to work through this with you, you know. And And I even said, I don't necessarily know if I agree or disagree, but I want to have this conversation, you know? And I think that's important because, like, I'm not going to agree to disagree. I'm not going to sacrifice my morals and my ethics, and neither should you. But I think we need to have a conversation, and a lot of people get turned off once you start having to defend your stance. And it's like, well, you need to defend your stance. And if you can't defend it adequately, you need to take this step back and modify it and see where the problems are and readdress it.
Exactly. I mean, I think that's why I wrote you, you posted up something and I just said, you know, the thing about growth and about being a better human means being willing to accept other possibilities than what you currently believe. Because, I mean, especially in situations when there's literally, there's factual evidence, there's been research done, there has been studies upon studies, scholarly articles. I mean, if you want to get down into, non-news, that's one thing. But if there's scholarly articles, there's research studies, there are so many different things that have been done to say that, no, this has definitely been happening. So for someone to stand up against all of that research, all of those times, and you have to fight a long battle, you have to be very entrenched in yourself, but then that leaves you to be stagnant in your growth.
I mean, I think that in itself is just like a really good point of, I mean, we all have the capability to be better, but we also all have the capability to be wrong. You know, you can be experiencing, you could be living with a disability and still have ableist attitudes towards other people. You know, we all internalize so much. We have to be willing to step out of that shell that we've built around ourselves. Otherwise, we're just not going to grow.
I think that really applies to the LGBTQ community. I think that people assume because they are identify as a letter that they automatically are just like amazing humans and they know everything and everything's great. And I can tell you that some of the most racist and misogynist and sexist people,
fat phobic
people and ageist, classist fucking people are in the LGBTQ community. Just because you're one marginalized identity does not make you a great person.
That is a very interesting point. So, many years ago now, I think it's 20 years ago. Jesus Christ. 20 something years ago, I came out. And I thought to myself that it would be a great idea to just go online and be a part of all this community. Like, you know, hey, they're saying we're born this way. I'm like, I'm born black. I'm born this way. So yay, I'm going to be a part of something and they're going to just love me. And I have never, I mean, to be honest, I mean, besides the racial tensions I've experienced throughout my life, I've never felt someone be so divisive, not someone, but a community be so divisive. I found myself for the first couple months, I would be fighting online every day. No, we do exist. I mean, we're going back and forth and we're doing all this typing and we're no. And they're like, yes, yes, yes. Well, we're better than you because you this and I don't want to talk to you and I can't date you. And it just was amazing. And then let's not even, I mean, I was just completely shocked. I spent the first couple months fighting. And then I saw that there, like, I would go to clubs and I noticed that there was, it was like being in like a movie where you had the black people over there. You had the other people of the trans over here. They were all separated and they weren't really having a good time all together. And it was just very eye-opening to me because I thought to myself, how can you say, accept me for who I am because I'm born this way, but you can't accept them because you don't understand, you know, transsexualism, and you don't accept them because, hey, they're just, you know, I'm not going to say the word, but they just dress in different clothing than how they present. I mean, How can you say that you want people to accept you, but you're not accepting of everyone else? And it really turned me off. And then, of course, being married, then it became this whole, people have said things to me against the community, not knowing that I'm in the community.
Oh, I know all about that.
So it's just shocking. It's like constant battles.
Yeah. I mean, just like, yeah, one, as like, I'm also in like a passing relationship. And so people just like assume, and I'm like, well, bitch, I'm more queer than you think. And then within the LGBTQ community, like, I've never felt like enough of anything. And, you know, it's like, it's just a phase. You have to pick a side. Or I'm like, someone's like weird, wild fantasy to include in a threesome. And I'm like, I'm not really interested in most people. So definitely not that. And it's just like, and I just, people refuse to acknowledge that bi and pan people exist, and that we can also, and if you're in a long-term relationship with someone, it can be monogamous or polyamorous, but it doesn't mean that you're less bi or pan or queer or whatever. Like, I just have so many feelings about it, and everyone's so mean.
I am so there. And like I said, when I first started out on this journey, I started it out because I started researching married women who like women. It's like the classic Google. and it started from there. And I found communities. There's a lot of married women. And so, but I am a woman of integrity, and not that anybody else is or isn't. But a lot of what they would say in the forums was, well, we're just going to get a best friend and have a best friend. And then nobody's going to know that that's more than my best friend. And I just felt like I could never live like that. So I made a decision. I was like, I'm going to go on the regular boards. Okay, you guys, thanks for all your help. I realized this is where it is. I'm going to go on the boards. And I went on the boards, and I got a lot of hate. And then I was always honest with everyone. So when I did go to the club, I was wearing my ring. And it was kind of like, you could tell there was like, there seemed to be like a cloud over my head where nobody would come over to me. I was like the plague or something. And I just, you know what? I did it. I used to go to the Pride Parade and you know, walk by myself.
How do you talk to your daughter about this stuff, about race and about being bi? How has that been going?
I hope Queenie doesn't listen to this.
Well, I took my very sweet time with telling Queen about being bi, because I didn't want her to be influenced by me.
Did you finally tell her?
Oh, I did. Recently,
oh, okay.
Actually.
Oh, okay.
Because I mean, like, within a couple of weeks.
Like, okay. Recently. Like, 2 months ago, you didn't tell her yet.
I did not. I know. We did have the conversation. She was going through something. And so I wanted her to know, because she thought that that I wouldn't understand. And so what she was going through, I just wanted her to know, no, Queen, that's not true. This is the truth. And so I still had, I think, like one or two pictures of the ex. So I showed her, but yeah. But I did recently just tell her, and that was a conversation. I wanted to wait until she was older because I didn't want to influence her. I didn't want her to think either way. Oh, it's great. Oh, it's bad. And then I didn't want to have the conversation about, well, the timeline says, and how did this all happen? And, you know, because, you know, if you did the math, then, you know, I was married when I was 20. So, you know, I didn't want to have that kind of conversation with a child. And I think that at this point in her life, she can grasp the understanding. And I just really wanted to relate to her. So that went actually pretty smooth. We talk about it occasionally and, you know, have our little moments with it, but it's nothing negative. And that's always how I am, you know. So that conversation, now the conversation about race in America has been extremely difficult. And it's been difficult, ironically, not for the reason I thought it would be difficult. It's difficult because she's further removed from the blatant history. So what I believe happened is, because, you know, I am Generation Z, The very oldest Generation Z, I think. I think I have it right. So
you're Gen Y.
I'm Gen Y?
Yeah. Queenie okay, so is Gen Z.
Okay, yes, X, Y, Z, yes. I'm sorry. Yes,
no, you're fine.
Y. So I'm the oldest of that generation. And we actually, I feel, have one foot in old school and one foot in new school. It's a very interesting place to be in. It's like a dichotomy of like, of everything, like anything. But so she doesn't really have the experience that I have where she could even relate to or understand. And whereas in times past, like I said, the stories get passed down. Don't go over here. Don't go do that. If you go in here, and it also doesn't help that she didn't grow up the way I grew up. Like my mother, before she became a chef, she was a cleaning lady and she cleaned homes, you know? So she doesn't get that. And so imagine you're cleaning a rich person's home. They're not really nice and they make it known. So that whole dynamic that I had, you know, been passed down to me was not passed down to her. So she doesn't, it's weird, but she, I don't want to say she denies, but she doesn't understand little things that I pick up on because I know she doesn't quite understand. And I have to just have patience and say that eventually she will see. Like I try to show the studies, Queen, I'm just going to tell you, I'm sorry I named you that because the studies show that they look at your name and then they bypass your app, you know, or when you see your friends all getting, you know, applications and they're getting these great jobs and you're not getting it. Don't think it has anything to do with you because it doesn't. So it's been very difficult to try to show somebody something that they can't see. And so it's kind of like I have to just, and she actually accused me of being racist at one point. She really did. Because she thought that I was too focused on race. When I was trying to show her, see this right here? Like I got a ticket for in a parking lot for imprudent speed. I'm serious. This was
bullshit,
a couple years
because
ago.
Because I've been in the car with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got a ticket for imprudent speed in a parking lot. Here. And I fought that for 3 years. But the thing is, when you go to court and my daughter was young, she, you know, it was the whole hassle to get there and no babysitting. And so it wind up, I just paid for it. But the thing is that she was young and she doesn't have those experiences. So she doesn't know. So it's been very challenging to try to show her something that she can't see. It's almost as if she's someone who is not Black. Trying to explain, for instance, it would be like explaining to someone white privilege who is white. And they say, that's not white privilege. That doesn't exist. It's kind of like that because she doesn't have that history and experiences. And it's not something that you can teach somebody. It's something you have to feel. You have to get angry about it. Like, why are you following me around? I've never stolen anything in my life. And the one time I accidentally put something in my pocket, I drove home and realized it and drove back to the store and turned it in and said, I forgot to pay for this and paid for it. So why are you? And I mean, it's blatant, but she doesn't have that. She, you know what? She says, Mom, they're just doing their job. Or, you know, she could just explain it away. She doesn't understand yet. So it's different to have to speak to a generation who. There was a shift in the way everything was rolled out. It was very much in your face when I was a kid, but then they very slowly took it back and made it very undercover and insidious. And so you really got to know it to see it. And she, unfortunately, good for her for not having to see it, to internalize it, to make her feel less than or different. But, you know, it's been challenging.
Well, I do think that she has internalized some of it based on our conversations with each other. You know, she doesn't feel beautiful. She doesn't, you know, and those are studies that are showing that like young Black girls do not feel beautiful. They don't feel comfortable in their skin. They hate their hair. They wish that they had different eye color, that so on and so forth, you know, and they did the doll study where most children be them white, black, Latina, Latino, they gravitate towards the white doll. I do think that she has internalized it, and it's showing, but it's showing more innocently than maybe what you've experienced.
So in my opinion with that, the difference between the two is representing, having representation. So in my opinion, regarding that particular issue, it doesn't involve anyone else. Not treatment. It's just, I told you, I think before, you know, it's very difficult to live in a world where you can't see yourself, you know, in a positive way. Like, I don't remember this lady, but there was a lady who someone took a video of. I don't even know the whole story. She, I believe, was in a fire, and she said something to the effect of, "Ain't nobody got time for that." Like, and people were really laughing, but I think I didn't watch the video. I don't even know what it is, but you don't see yourself in a positive light, not enough to be like, "Hey, I could do this. I could be the doctor." You know, in that regard, just being black alone is a challenge. And so that is what she's dealing with not really liking her hair because it's not curly and it's not straight, you know, and, you know, I have this color skin and it's not lighter and it's not darker, you know. So that is a different dynamic than the racism, which is about the environment in your world, whereas this is about your perception of you. So it's a little bit different, but I understand what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I think, you know, talking to you about it is, you know, you have always been authentic. I've always looked to you for friendship and for education and just chit-chatting because we have learned so much from each other over the years. But I think like talking to you about these things that like I wouldn't necessarily know is incredibly helpful, you know? And I think this is where a lot of like the things that are being talked about today with anti-racism and everything has to continue going back to what are Black people saying? What are they talking about? How are they talking about themselves? How are they talking about their experiences?
But I think also, like, on top of that, that it's a good way to highlight how anti-racism and Black Lives Matter and all of this, like, great stuff that's being highlighted right now is, if all of that can come into fruition, it's going to help literally everyone because, you know, not only is Queenie 16 or not only is Queenie like a Black girl, but she's 16 and being 16 really fucking sucks. And, you know, you're being told what you need to look like and just like in a general way and or like what you should do to get someone to like you. And like you have lots of hormones and yeah, like, don't know how to process your emotions. And so, like, you know, if we can start to address all these issues and inequalities within race, then maybe we can start talking about, like, beauty standards and how fucked up they are and dismantling capitalism and, like, why we're, like, why teenage girls are getting ads for, like, all these crazy beauty tools and whatnot. Like,
no, I totally agree. As a matter of fact, recently she said to me, "Mom, I hate my body because all the other Black girls have big butts and big breasts and I don't." And there's kind of an expectation based on some stereotype that's now making her feel bad. And all of her dance teachers have been saying, "Oh my gosh, she's like perfect for ballet if she was just a little bit taller, but she's great." But she can't see it. It's hard to see that because in reality, if all your friends are talking about, you know, Black jokes, so to speak, then you're going to take that and feel a little insecure if you don't fit the stereotype. So most certainly, beauty standards are huge. I mean, hair alone. I mean, why do you think there's been a few movies on Black hair? And that's because it is important to have this discussion. It is not okay. Do not touch my hair. Like people do try to do it. It would be funny if it was just something that was like a joke, but it's real. The reason these movies, I believe, have come out is because it is real. And people have, you know, no matter what kind of hairstyle I've had. it's interesting. It's kind of like, it reminds me of when they took those, I think it was a black child, I think, and they put him in the zoo, the Bronx Zoo. I forget how many years ago it was.
It was like in the early 1900s, I believe.
Yeah. And it was like, it's like being an experiment. Like, so what happens if you stay in the sun? Do you tan? It's weird questions and craziness that eventually, hopefully, we can all just realize that we're just people. We're just people. And that would be so great.
It's almost just like seen as you're exotic and you're different, you know? And I know that plagues a lot of Asian communities as well, of just being exotic. And it's just like, no, come on, like, they're just people. They just have, you know, different type of skin. It's okay.
Well, and I think that, you know, throughout history, if you want to use the word exotic, it's exotic with the stain on it. It's not a positive exotic. It's not a desired exotic.
Right.
So I don't want to say a disdain, but it's definitely not a positive
thing. And othering. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what I use a lot. Like, just people are othered. Like, you're the other. You're not accepted into the group. And I think then, like, if you use the word exotic, it sounds nice. You're still othered, but it also is like this, like, weird sexualized othering. So you could be good in some senses, but also still stereotyped.
Yeah, it's a very interesting dynamic in general. Just all the different things that define you when you should just be able to define yourself.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, we're going to continue doing what we've been constantly just working towards. But if you ever feel like you want to come back and share more stories, you are always more than welcome.
I really appreciate that.
Yeah, of course.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this interview as much as we enjoyed talking to Ebony. If you want to send us an email, you can reach out at fraupowpodcast@gmail.com, or you can find us on Facebook and Instagram at fraupowpodcast. And as always, friends, don't be a dick.
Woo!
Good job.